From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Yes, it's us again, me and Ken Drews, here to answer your latest crop of urgent garden questions about topics as diverse as using landscape fabric and growing clivia, creative staking, and more. But first, this message.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
It's Urgent Garden Question Week on the radio show and podcast, which means my old friend Ken Drews is here. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Margaret.
Uh-oh, I can hear in your voice that you're working on fall cleanup over there. Oh, boy. So yeah, let's get right to it. But I guess I looked in some bulb catalogs. You know, I'm like browsing through them the other day, and I'm thinking to myself, oh, it's already well into October, and I haven't ordered any bulbs. Are you planting any?
I was looking at a catalog, and I thought, good thing it's August. Only it's not August.
I know.
And I didn't order any.
I know.
Can't believe it.
I know. I think I might put in a last-minute order for some minor little guy things, you know. But that's about it. I don't think I can undertake. It's been so wet and so crazy lately. You know, I'm afraid to this last minute tackle anything. So,
well, some things might be sold out. That's kind of a problem.
Yeah.
That happens when you order too late. But, you know, they say you're supposed to get the narcissus in the ground by September. I pretty much never do.
November?
Well, I figure if you can get a pickaxe in the ground.
There you go.
And make a hole.
Yeah.
And plant those. Well, I'm exaggerating, but you can get away with near murder.
Wow.
And plant them anyway, especially if you have bulbs you already bought and you haven't planted. Just get them in the ground.
Yeah, because they're not going to last in the garage. That's for darn sure, you know.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. So we do have lots and lots of reader and listener questions. One is about clivia, which is not a bulb, but actually kind of looks like an amaryllis if you look at the plant growing, the leaves, right? The strappy
right.
leaves.
But it's evergreen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Adrian says, who's in Northeast Pennsylvania Zone 5, an expert gardener, except when it comes to house plants, Adrian says. Friend gave Adrian an old clivia. Last fall, said, you know, put it in a window, leave it alone. And she watered it minimally last winter, she says, kept it in indirect light in her living space, never bloomed. And she put it outside on the deck, out of direct, you know, baking sun, but watered it minimally, didn't repot it. Uh-oh, what's going on? Gave it some fish emulsion a couple of times, but, you know, wondering how to make this plant happy and bloom. Do you have any clivia?
I do.
Me too, yeah. Yeah. Are they oldies, big oldies? Or?
One of them is really old with lots of leaves, and I haven't repotted it. It's been in the pot for years. I feed it a little bit in the spring, but I don't feed it that much.
Uh-huh.
And I don't put it in any sun outside. It's in very bright light.
Yeah.
And it blooms its head off. It doesn't bloom in the winter. I know that yours bloom in the winter, but
mine
blooms. Well, I usually get a bloom, you know, in late winter and then more. It was blooming, I think, in, I was going to say August, but what month is this?
I
think it did have a bloom in July, believe it or not.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's the interesting thing about them, you know, and you said mine bloom in the winter. And that's really only if I concentrate and give it exactly what it wants, as if I'm like a clivia hobbyist and I'm going to bring my plant to the show and I've got to have it blooming on time. Like there's a formula for doing that, working back from showtime, and most of the clivia shows are like late March, you know, like the 20th of March, you know, something like that. And you can kind of count back. But the key is dry and cool.
Right.
And they say, so, you know, a lot of the experts say October 1st to January 22nd, not to be too precise, you know, no water. And at that time, during that time, and I mean, that's drastic, right?
Yeah.
Between 35 and 55 degrees for that period of time. for a minimum of five weeks. So it has to be at least 5 weeks. No water between October and January, but at least 5 weeks of that chill as well. So that's a hard combination to come up with in your house. You know what I mean? Even a mudroom, or you have a sun porch, right?
Yeah, but how are we going to get it down below 55 degrees if it's not?
Right, exactly.
So we're not going to participate in the show, I think.
I think we're not going to make the show. But it's kind of like, you know, they have a they have like a timeline, and you hold the plant dormant, they say, until 8 weeks before the show time, and then you start bringing them out of dormancy by watering gradually and raising the temperature to 60-ish, you know, so that they're not rushing into growth and pushing their flower stalk too fast. But again, for the regular folks like us, you find your brightest, coolest place and stop watering.
Right.
And give it that. So it's sitting there. It's happy. It's got some light. But you give it no water all winter. And I think that's where people get a little confused. And definitely don't feed it in the off season.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So dry and as cool as you can possibly get it in the house. I mean, it's not, we don't want it to freeze, but.
No.
Definitely cool and dry, and that's how you get it to bloom.
Right.
And if you have a very young plant, it's not going to bloom.
No, that's the other thing. That's the other thing. And I think changing its regimen, and I've noticed this with other things that I've adopted from somewhere or someone. This was an adopted plant, a gift plant or whatever. You know, sometimes the first year in a new regimen, plants also sulk or off schedule, if that makes any sense. But left, if you don't have enough cool in the late fall into that early winter, if you don't have enough cool, like my mudroom might be 55 or 60-ish, it's not, you know, 45 or 50. It's just not. Mm-hmm. So my plants tend to bloom more like you said, like July or August even. A lot of times June would be what you'll get. It kind of depends on your conditions. So anyway, that's for Adrian. Hopefully that'll be helpful. A totally different subject. Joshua is asking us about, he's in South Jersey area. Tough year in Zone 7A, he says. Lots of rain, lots of heat then, et cetera. Critters galore. And so he decided that he was going to kind of get a clean slate during fall cleanup, and this is in the vegetable garden. He says, I was going to put a couple of inches of leaf compost over the veggie garden to go into next spring with a replenished spirit and garden soil, and should I place landscape fabric over the top of that and sort of, you know, pin it down, stake it down, or would it be better not to? So landscape fabric, where are you with that?
Oh, my gosh. there's so many things that people try to put over on us gardeners. It's really a shame. I can't think of any use for landscape fabric. Really.
That's funny. I hate it as well. Having once used it many years ago in creating a path and putting it underneath the sort of mulch material of the path, and lo, these, you know, 25 years later or something, it's still down there, and it occasionally, like, pops up at the edges or something. Like, it'll never deteriorate.
I'm not even exactly sure what it's for.
Well, I think it was one of those things where when people were, like, laying patios and they imagined they didn't want any weeds to ever pop up through the cracks or walkways or, again, like a mulched path, it was supposed to thwart, is an underlayment, you know, to sort of thwart weed stuff coming up into the path or the cracks or crevices.
Yeah, but don't you think most weeds come down from the top?
Well, I do, a lot of them, but there are also things that go sideways and up and whatever.
That's true.
So I think that might have been the idea, but I'm not crazy about it. But how would you vegetable garden, want to get a fresh start, didn't have a great season. What's the condition you would leave it in this fall?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what the point of this is. The idea, is it to keep the material on the top from blowing away, or is it
to keep some things
from getting down in there?
I think maybe to keep it in place, but I don't worry so much about that. And I put on my fall amendments kind of heavy enough that they kind of, once they get wet from the weather, they kind of stay in place.
Right. He didn't say it was leaves. He said it was
leaf compost.
Mm-hmm. Compost, right. Yeah. So I don't think there's going to be a problem. Just skip the cloth.
Yeah, I think skip the cloth too. Good. Okay. So we're in agreement. We're finally in agreement. No, I'm only teasing. I'm teasing. I had a funny question about chestnuts, American chestnuts, which were destroyed by a blight, as we know, a long time ago, as we've all heard. And this reader, listener, et cetera, wanted to know, she said she and her husband have a farm in western Pennsylvania, in the mountains of the so-called Chestnut Ridge, and they have discovered on their land a 50-foot-tall, 8-inch caliper, what they think is an American chestnut. And it had, there were 20 seed husks on the ground, 3 seeds in each one, so about 60 seeds, wants to know, could they be propagated or whatever? And I know this is probably not something either one of us has done, since chestnuts are not extinct, but, you know, mostly extinct. So she wanted to know, Heidi wanted to know some of our suggestions. I right away said American Chestnut Foundation, because I think they have a great website. Have you ever seen it? Have you ever gone to that website?
Yeah, a long time ago, but yes, I have.
Yeah, and they have, like, great resources about, I mean, first of all, ID, because there are other, you know, chinkapins and other, and there's Asian, Chinese chestnuts and so forth, other chestnut lookalikes that aren't American chestnut. And they have information. You can even send in seeds and get them identified and, you know, et cetera, tested.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, they're great. And they have, you know, harvesting tips, like where do you, you know, once you pick them up off the ground, do you try to pry them open and take the nuts out or not? And I think the answer is not. But, you know, and what do you do in winter? And if you were going to plant them, the no-no about, as you would probably guess what not to do? Plant them out in the garden because?
Someone will eat them.
I wonder who that would be.
Not me.
The same critters who would love to dig up all the bulbs that I didn't plant, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
I've actually started the Chinese chestnuts from seed. They're very easy to germinate, which is irrelevant. But I've kept them moist in the refrigerator, and they sprout in the refrigerator and then potted them up. But, you know, what am I going to do with a Chinese chestnut tree?
Right. The other thing is that, and I saw this on the American Chestnut Foundation website, is that this disclaimer that if there's only one tree, it would not have been pollinated, so the nuts, the resulting nuts, would not be viable.
Oh, so you would have nuts, but they might not be.
So, yes, it is.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So they wouldn't, be fertile or whatever. Yeah. So anyway, but yeah, I think it's just acf.org for people who are interested. And with a transcript of the show, of course, we'll give more details. But yeah, so that was a different kind of question, not one we had gotten before.
And they have information on the quote-unquote disease-resistant varieties that people are working on, which is wonderful.
Yes. So, so a worthwhile place to have a peek and learn more about chestnuts, their history, their future, et cetera, and their relatives, too. Carolyn wrote to us, Ken. This is one that you're going to have to answer because I'm not so good at the...
I love it when you set me up like this.
Well, you're more artistic than I am. I mean, and I mean that honestly. I mean that. I mean, you're a painter, you're a photographer, you're crafty, and you have those kinds of, you have some skills that I'm not as good at. So hopefully you have this skill, which has to do with sort of staking things. Carolyn had read a recent interview I did with the person who did the dahlias at Longwood Gardens and said, you know, the stakes really bother her. They're ugly, she says, and difficult to hide if one plants the dahlias in the garden and not in just a separate, you know, kind of cutting area where you can use more workmanlike supports. And, you know, she says, I know one should have plants in front of them to sort of hide some of the stakes, but if the dahlias grow, you know, large, they topple over, they're top heavy, what's good staking? And this really applies to any plant, right? Staking tactics. What do you do a lot of staking in your garden?
You have to. I have to.
So some examples.
Well, it's funny because I'm listening to you and I'm thinking dahlias are not really very pretty plants.
No.
You don't grow them for the nice foliage. And some of them are very tall, 5 foot or 6 feet tall, and then they have those very heavy giant flowers. So it's the staking is more utility, you know, it's something to to do. But with dahlias, when I plant the tuber, I put a stake in the ground at the same time, mm-hmm. and I know where my tuber is, mm-hmm. and I use probably a bamboo stake. That's what I use most often. And I don't think about, you know, I'm thinking about utility. I'm not thinking about beauty. But if I were to think about how could I do something for dahlias that was a little more attractive, I might make kind of an open fence or something out of stakes on the north side of the plant so that I could tie them to it later, or a teepee, something like that.
A teepee would be nice. Like, in that, by that we mean like a tripod, like taking three bamboo canes, sinking them in well, but then gathering them at the top with some cord or whatever, some twine. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think if you make it, if you want it to look good, just make it intentional.
Right. So that it doesn't look like, oh, your stake is showing. It looks like, oh, they.
And it's
right.
bent and it's crooked.
Right.
And, make
right.
it straight.
Right. And important. And one of the other things you can do if you don't want to have an intentional, device like you just said, like the fence behind them, so to speak, or not a literal fence, or a teepee or whatever, would be, and I don't mean this snidely, but to grow some of the less tall varieties, because there's such a range of flower colors and sizes and shapes in many sized plants, and mm-hmm. also to pinch a little, you know, not just not a ton, but, you know, there are also, and obviously to grow them in full sun so that they don't stretch. In other words, anything you can do to minimize them getting to be sky high, right, which is going to be the biggest problem of all, having to have a too tall stake or a very tall stake and have them flop over anyway at the end. But I like the idea of making it intentional. I think that's good advice for supports in general, right?
Well, as you're saying this, I'm thinking you could make girdles or corsets out of chicken wire, which would be intentional, but not necessarily pretty.
Right. No. But you're saying intentional, like this is part of the look of this garden. Aesthetically
that,
intentional.
Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I agree. And I think the other good thing about the bamboo is that if need be, like say you put it in extra tall and the plant doesn't grow to that height, you could typically take your shears, right, and snip off some. I mean, you don't have to have it sticking out, but you're going to have it sticking out while the plant grows up no matter what, right? So your intentional idea, like the fence backdrop or whatever, is probably better.
It's funny, the bamboo stakes are that odd color of green. I don't know how that started or what that's about.
I like the natural ones.
But I have painted my stakes in my lifetime. Sometimes I've painted them pale green to match the plant. And I've also used, our world famous invisible color and painted some stakes, and you can't even see them.
Which is kind of like a dark taupey color. Like a mm-hmm. Weimaraner color, Weimaraner dog color, that kind of color.
Well, I always think of it as the color of bark and dirt, but Weimaraner's nice.
Yeah, Weimaraner. We're going to rename that paint Weimaraner. I like the natural. I can't stand the green ones, besides the fact that the stuff comes off on your fingers if it's wet.
That's right.
It's revolting. It's not a natural green to me. It doesn't look natural. So I like the undyed ones, but they're harder to find. Sometimes you have to order them.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Staking. Okay. So we have another question. Drum roll, please. Mm-hmm. Cheryl. Cheryl is asking, she's in Ohio, Zone 6A. She'd like to plant a native focal point understory tree or shrub that can handle wet conditions in clay soil that is alkaline. Oh, my goodness. So it's on the edge of the woods, and it's near black walnut trees, a lot of complexity. But she did a substantial amount of homework, and she got kind of excited about a particular viburnum, and which was dentatum, viburnum dentatum. And then when she called local nurseries to see if they stocked it, she was told by a couple of places that they stopped purchasing it because of the viburnum leaf beetle and how much damage it does to that particular species. Have you ever had VLB in your garden, Ken, in New Jersey?
I'm not quite sure. I have something that's disfigured the viburnums, and the leaves are all puckery, and I don't have that currently. But is that the symptom of the beetle?
No, but more like holes and stuff, like it's been eaten and, yeah, no.
No. You mean like a Japanese beetle look kind of thing?
Mm-hmm.
No, I haven't had that.
I mean, not exactly like that, but yes, that direction. Skeletonized or, you know, eaten like an insect, a herbivorous insect.
Finally, there's one thing I don't have.
Oh, good. Okay. I have had it. And it's very interesting. Cornell, and again, with the transcript, we can give all the details and the links to some of these reference sites because it's hard. It would be hard to list everything here out loud. But Cornell University for many years has maintained a viburnum leaf beetle sort of mini part of its website. And it rates all the species, both native and Asian ornamental ones, from highly susceptible to most resistant to the beetle. So mm-hmm. you can choose using that as a reference. So dentatum, the arrowwood, you know, is one of the highly susceptible. So those nurserymen were right in telling her that it was a risky business. I have the beetle, and what I do is they also love the cranberry bush viburnum, both the European and the American one. They love that with like little mapley-like leaves. And so what I do is I have in two areas of the garden at extreme distances, like not in the main beds or whatever, but sort of where you don't see it, I have one big plant of each of those. And so the beetles go to those. I use it as like a trap crop, like farmers do when they have a particular pest. They might may a few weeks earlier than their main crop that they don't want to have get eaten. They may plant a relative of that crop at a distance and lure the pest. Ha ha, how tricky.
this is like sacrificial shrubs.
It is indeed. Exactly, but like a trap crop, like that's if you don't want, you know, some kind of brassica pest to eat your whatever main crop of a brassica, you at a distance plant radishes really early and you'll have lots of those pests on your radishes. You know, that's the thinking. Mm-hmm. So I have some of the most susceptible ones so that my moderately susceptible ones don't get as damaged or damaged. And then the other thing is that from late fall until before the beetles wake, the larvae hatch again in spring, you see these sort of little bumps on the newer twigs that sort of toward the ends of the branches that are egg cases that they're overwintering their eggs on the twigs of the viburnums. And so if you cut those off and throw them in the garbage, you know, get them away, you'll have fewer beetles. Have you ever used anything like that? Have you ever heard of spinosad?
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you ever used that for anything?
I believe I have. I don't remember the results. It was a long time ago, but I have, yes.
Yeah, because I've read also that that's one thing sort of the natural things that can be done. But I have to look more into that. And with the transcript, I will. So what are you up to? Are you like in the throes of cleanup?
Well, I'm sitting here thinking of what you could plant, what that woman could plant in that situation. And I can think of a lot of things, but they want acid soil, unfortunately.
Right.
I have alkaline soil and I have water. And I've planted some taxodium.
Oh.
And they're handling it, but they're trees, although there are dwarf ones, and sycamore. And Nissa sylvatica, there's some interesting dwarf ones of that and some larches, just so we don't leave her up in the air completely.
All right, so good. So we had a few suggestions. And like I said, I'll give all the links to some more information about viburnum leaf beetle and the other things we've been talking about. Ken, we have squandered another segment.
Oh, really?
Yes, but I'm glad to speak to you. Now get out there and do your cleanup.
Well, I'm still schlepping plants in, if you can believe
so am that. So am I. So I'll talk to you soon. Yes.
Thank you so much, Margaret.
Thank you.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. Find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or at Facebook or Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.